Today is Thursday, December 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, emotional tributes at the funeral of America's 41st president.
I said, "Dad, I love you, and you've been a wonderful father." And the last words he would ever say on earth were, "I love you too."
With millions on the brink of starvation in Yemen, will peace talks in Sweden lead to a resolution? USA Gymnastics files for bankruptcy as it tries to survive a sex scandal and a new movie about a girl raised in the jungle by wolves. It's all on today's International Edition. The nation bade fair goodbye to the late former President George H.W. Bush with high praise, cannon salutes, and gentle humor Wednesday, celebrating the life of the Texan who embraced a lifetime of service in Washington and was the last president to fight for the U.S. in World War II. Former presidents looked on at Washington's National Cathedral as the 43rd chief executive. George W. Bush eulogized his father as the brightest of 1,000 points of light.
Taught us what it means to be a wonderful father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. He was firm in his principles and supportive as we began to seek our own ways. He encouraged and comforted, but never steered. We tested his patience. I know I did. But he always responded with the great gift of unconditional love.
After 3 days of remembrance in the capital city, the Air Force plane with Bush's casket left for a final service in Houston and burial later today at his family plot on the presidential library grounds at Texas A&M University in College Station. His final resting place is alongside Barbara Bush, his wife of 73 years, and Robin Bush, the daughter who died of leukemia at age 30. Tom DeFrank is a veteran White House correspondent and the contributing editor to the National Journal. He explained to International Edition's Sarah Williams about his first meeting with George H.W. Bush in China in 1974.
I first met George H.W. Bush in Thanksgiving of 1974. It's a long story, but basically I was traveling with President Ford in Asia. And after Ford met with President Leonid Brezhnev in Vladivostok, he sent Kissinger to Beijing to start arranging a visit by Ford to Beijing in 1975. And so I was, my boss said, you should go with Kissinger. So I was thrilled. And when the Kissinger traveling party got to Beijing, the U.S. rep for the People's Republic of China, George Bush, at a reception at his residence, and that's where I met him for the first time. He walked into the middle of a angry snit by Secretary of State Kissinger, who had just accused me mistakenly of writing fiction. And as Kissinger stormed away, the U.S. rep to the People's Republic of China said to me, "Now, what the hell was that all about? Hi, I'm George Bush." And so that's how we met 44 years ago. And over the years, the fact that I think that I'm from Texas, I went to school at Texas A&M, where everybody now knows his library is, and a lot of other shared experiences and cultural ties. He and I did a lot of business for a lot of years for a very long time, and I will always be grateful to his personal and professional generosities with me.
Yeah, I bet he never forgot you, partly because of that, but that's a good story. What are some of your other favorite recollections of the late President Bush?
He, as we say in Texas, he was the real deal. And I'm not talking about his political life or his ideological views. He was just a good human being. I remember once Secretary of State Jim Baker once said to me, the day I was going over to have an interview with Bush for the first time, he says, "Now, be ready for this. You'll go in the room, and before you sit down, he'll say, 'Is this chair going to be comfortable for you? Is the sun going to be in your eyes? Do you need to go to the bathroom? Do you need a drink of water?' He will be solicitous to a fault about you." And he said it's one of the best things about him. And I found that to be absolutely the case, and I found it time and time and time and time again. I remember once My wife and I had just been engaged, and this is right before the White House press party of 1989. And we go through the receiving line, and he asked my fiance if she's a Washingtonian, and she said, no, but I will be soon, sir, and showed him her engagement ring. And Bush kind of shut down the receiving line for about 30 seconds just to talk to her and show the ring to Barbara Bush. And a week later, we got invited out of the blue to a Bush movie screening in the White House Theater. So that was the kind of thing that I remember, large and small gestures, the master of the small gesture, a guy who had every right to feel himself special and patrician and elite, but never behaved like that. He was much like President Gerald Ford, an ordinary guy in the good sense of the word ordinary. And again, the personal and professional kindnesses are what will endure with me for a long time.
You know, one of the things I think was interesting about him, even though he was born in Boston, grew up in Connecticut, was educated in Massachusetts and in Connecticut, but early in his work life, he moved to Texas, and even though he lived a number of places, of course, here in Washington, D.C. and around the world because of his job, he very much was a Texan, and he will be buried there in Texas, and that's a state where you're from. So he always had a strong tie, though, to
right.
Texas.
At the Bush Library once, he said to me, he said, if Barbara goes first, I'm selling the house in Houston and moving here. Of course, which he didn't do, but that's what he said to me. And I said, and what does Mrs. Bush think about that? And he said, poorly. And so, but he's done the next best thing. He's going to be buried there with his beloved wife and his beloved three-year-old daughter, Robin. On the grounds of the Bush Library in College Station, Texas. He liked the whole frontier experience and the frontier mentality and sociology.
That is Tom DeFrank, veteran White House correspondent and the contributing editor to the National Journal. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Three people are dead, 44 injured in a Dominican Republic blast. The U.S. challenges Russian claims in the Sea of Japan. The Russian court jails 77-year-old rights activist. And a new report finds greenhouse gas emissions set a record. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, feverish media speculation has been raged ahead of Robert Mueller's sentencing recommendations for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, fueled by hopes the court filing would provide fresh insight into the special counsel's probe of Russian interference into the 2016 presidential election. What emerged instead from the heavily redacted document was a deepening mystery and a few hints that the nearly 18-month-old probe is headed in unknown and previously unexpected directions. In the sentencing memo filed in federal court late Tuesday, Mueller's prosecutors recommended that Flynn, an early cooperating witness in the sweeping Russia probe, receive no prison time for lying to the FBI because he was provided or has provided substantial assistance to several ongoing investigations since pleading guilty last December. Joining us now is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. So what is your take on these latest developments and what we do and don't know?
I think this is a really dramatic event, and I would think if I were the president's lawyers, I'd be really, really concerned. And this is why. When you follow these things, there's a move by the special counsel and then a response by potential witnesses and so forth. It's really worth looking at the text as the exchanges go back and forth. What Mueller did, of course, was in response to a court demand. The court says basically, hey, Mr. Mueller, what kind of sentence should I give this fellow Flynn? Did he help or take the case of Manafort, where there are allegations he lied? Obviously, that information that's passed to the court is really important. But what isn't often understood is that those are signals sent to opposing counsel as well.
And what is the message you think it's sending?
The message that it's saying, sentencing memoranda are very important. Important for the obvious reason, what is the special counsel telling the sentencing judge about the cooperation, in this case of Mr. Flynn? But they actually have a much greater significance, and that is, what are they telling the lawyers for other people who are implicated in all this? For example, Mr. Trump's lawyers, perhaps his children's lawyers, and so forth. And by having such a lengthy sentencing memoranda and then blacking out large portions of it, the president, his lawyer, and so forth, all these other folks are likely to have at least a hint of what's been blacked out. And that hint will tell the witnesses the special counsel has this information. And that's designed to scare, and it does.
The fact that they were willing to recommend no prison time whatsoever, what does that say?
That says that we've got a lot, and this guy gave it to us. And so that, together with the blacked out sections that I suspect have enough that's not blacked out, that people like the president and other potential witnesses can infer what that section is about. The intention is for the special counsel to say to them, we've got you, pal.
Who is the special counsel sending the message to?
But I believe that the message I'm speaking about that was contained in that sentencing memo is aimed at people way up the line, whether it's all the way to the president, whether it's the president's children, whether it's other people. I can't say. I don't know. But it's aimed at the people way up the line.
How concerned should the president be right now?
I think he should be very concerned.
What should he be concerned about?
Well, I think I've said from the very beginning, I think his biggest, again, this is speculation. I don't know. I'm not his lawyer. And if I were, I couldn't tell you. But I think my instinct is that the president's greatest concern is over money laundering.
So you think the whole issue is follow the money type of situation?
Yes, I do.
Do you think this thing is coming to a conclusion?
No. I think we've got some more pretty senior indictments, and then I think there'll be a lull, and then who knows what the climax is.
That's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. A team from Yemen's Saudi-backed government is in Sweden to attend peace talks starting today with members of the Iran-aligned Houthi rebels in a renewed UN push to end a war that has pushed millions in the country to the brink of starvation. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal if he thinks this could actually lead to a peace agreement.
First of all, let me be very straightforward about this. This is not a peace negotiation. This is basically intended to, quote-unquote, build some degree of confidence between the two opposing parties so they can go back and talk to their supporters and work out something which may allow for some compromise down the road. What we can see today is the following. The position of the Saudi-led forces has been weakened by the fact that the U.S. Senate has taken a position that they want to cut off assistance to Saudi Arabia and other countries for their fight in Yemen. Now, that has certainly created a new political circumstances and situation over there. On the other hand, as far as the Houthis are concerned, they have their own dissensions in their own bloc, which is also causing difficulties, and also the fact that Hodeidah port is so much under intense attack and is becoming increasingly difficult to hold on to. They also need to work something out so as to get to a situation where some sort of a status quo ante can be achieved. That's basically what it is. So the two sides that are meeting there are meeting because of pressures that are affecting their ability to continue to fight the war as it was. What you are really looking at is the two sides who will be basically not even having face-to-face discussions. All this will be done by Mr. Griffith, will be going from one party to the other party, and so on and so forth, and will be aimed largely at what you could at most call confidence building or some easing of tensions, which may allow for a ray of hope that down the road they can meet and talk about actual peace. So these are not peace negotiations. That is certainly off the table.
But it sounds to me like you're saying that both internal and external factors are prodding the two sides to end this conflict.
Not necessarily to end the conflict, but certainly to ease off on the conflict itself. The conflict, remember, is a very fundamental one. That conflict really lies in Yemen itself. It's the absence of what we call Yemeni nationhood that is complicating matters. And other countries, including Saudi Arabia, UAE on one side, Iran on the other side, etc., are taking advantage of the situation. Remember, this whole thing began in 2011 when this Arab Spring took place. The conflict was very severe at that time and drew the lines. And those lines have become solidified over time and now being supported by two sides which are completely opposed to each other and therefore making things much more complicated and difficult for the two sides to get together. So it's really a very fundamental problem that exists within Yemen, which is prodding and encouraging other countries in the region who want to establish their hegemonic control in the region itself to continue to fight in a proxy fashion. So what we have on our hands is the following. These two parties, these two delegations, will be there in Sweden, outside Stockholm. They will be carrying out indirect negotiations, but the maximum that I can see they will be willing to do would be two or three things. One of those would be, to what extent can prisoner exchange take place, number one. Number two, is it possible to ease off pressure on Hodeidah? And maybe a compromise may have to be reached where the United Nations will probably take over and then provide basic import facilities for purposes of avoiding famine in Yemen itself. The third possibility, which I think is not a very likely possibility, but they're going to hope for it, is to see if the Sana'a airport can be opened up. At this moment, Sana'a airport has been heavily bombarded, number one. Number two, the airspace is under the control of the Saudi coalition, and they will not let any plane coming in to land over there. So under the circumstances, a major compromise may have to be sought from the Saudis that they will let Sana'a airport to be opened. So Yemen gets another alternative option for maintaining links with the rest of the world apart from Hodeidah. Whether this will happen is anybody's guess. But my feeling is, if one were to move in that direction, if one were to do at least these two things, move on Hodeidah, provide for security, and maybe give it in there to the United Nations to maintain and look after, and the Sana'a airport, if some sort of a compromise can be reached on these two things, that will be a major landmark and could actually set into motion some sort of a process whereby the two parties in Yemen will start to work out their differences within their groups and therefore eventually move towards, in the distant future, not in the near future, towards some sort of a compromise and peace treaty.
And a lot of credit would go to UN Envoy Martin Griffiths for arranging all of this.
Very much so. But you see, let's not forget about it, that what happened to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia did matter, because that led to some sort of a response from the rest of the world, from the region, and particularly from the United States. The Senate position that has been taken has clearly sent a message. You cannot go on the way it is. You have to bring an end to it.
All right, that's Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal. USA Gymnastics has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The embattled organization filed the petition Wednesday as it attempts to reach settlements in the dozens of sex abuse lawsuits it faces and to forestall its potential demise at the hands of the U.S. Olympic Committee. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
USA Gymnastics is facing 100 lawsuits representing 350 athletes who blame the group for failing to supervise Larry Nassar, a team doctor accused of molesting them. Gymnasts like Jordan Weber came forward.
I'm an Olympian. Despite being abused, I worked so hard and managed to achieve my goal.
The chair of USA Gymnastics, Karen Carson, says mediation attempts failed to gain traction, so they are turning to bankruptcy. There's also an attempt by the United States Olympic Committee to decertify USA Gymnastics. In an open letter, the CEO of the USOC told gymnasts they deserve better.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, December is AIDS Awareness Month, and there's been much progress in recent years, but it is still not curable, with many of the cases stemming in Africa. Here in the U.S., though, children are being born infected with the virus, 65% of them African-American. Joining us now to discuss is Elizabeth Roshan, Vice President of Nursing with the Association of Women's Health Obstetrics and Neonatal Nurses. So, how big of a problem is AIDS now in the United States?
Yes, HIV is still something that the CDC measures. And in fact, there are approximately 1.1 million Americans living with HIV. And I think it's important that we highlight the term living with HIV, because even 30 years ago, most individuals didn't live but a couple of years after their diagnosis. And now you can live with the correct medication regimens. You can live a fairly full life with HIV.
And as far as women go, I understand that many women, thousands of them, are living with HIV and giving birth. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And approximately 8,500 women per year give birth to newborns, and those women are HIV positive.
Are they doing that unknowingly or knowingly?
So, interestingly enough, most states now require HIV testing upon discovery of pregnancy. So most states now require routine testing for HIV at the first signs of pregnancy, and then again between 26 to 28 weeks gestation. So many states do require not only one test of it for HIV during the course of pregnancy, but two. So certainly treatment can be started immediately upon diagnosis or upon finding out you're pregnant. And then again, to make sure that if there has been a seroconversion, that treatment can also be readily available during pregnancy as well.
And what do we do to lower the risk of infection for newborns?
So certainly education is probably the most important thing we can do to lower the risk of transmission to newborns. And certainly besides education is knowing your status. So getting tested for HIV as early as possible. And then also for women who are considering pregnancy is to also know what your status is. And indeed, if you do happen to be HIV positive, to get treatment right away so that you can give your baby the best chance of being born HIV negative.
What should women know if they have HIV and are either pregnant or would like to become pregnant?
So sure, if a woman has HIV, the most important thing that she can do is to take her medications to treat HIV infection. And these medications are called ART, or antiretroviral therapy. And it's important to take them the right way every day. And what these medications do is it decreases what's known as the viral load of HIV. So that as the viral load decreases, so does the risk of transmission to the fetus or the newborn upon delivery.
Would you say that this is an issue around the world with women?
Certainly in some countries around the world, it is a much greater issue. The sub-Saharan areas in Africa, for example, are still quite impacted by HIV, but certainly organizations around the world, including the World Health Organization, USAID, other relief agencies and organizations, do certainly make every effort to ensure that women, no matter where they are in the world, can have access to antiretroviral therapies, to HIV therapies, to ensure that their babies, that their newborns have the lowest risk of being born HIV positive. Certainly, a last thought I would have is that if you are a woman of childbearing age, or you are a woman who's pregnant with HIV, it is so important to know that there is hope. that there is hope to have a newborn who is HIV negative. And with the right medications, with the right treatment, with the right treatment plan for your HIV status, that there is hope to have an HIV negative newborn in the face of HIV.
All right, that's Elizabeth Roshan, Vice President of Nursing with the Association of Women's Health Obstetrics and Neonatal Sir. Well, it took nearly 5 years for director Andy Serkis to bring his vision of Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book to the screen. However, as VOA's David Byrd tells us, Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle premieres this month in theaters and on Netflix.
It took nearly 5 years for director Andy Serkis to bring his vision of Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book to the screen. However, as VOA's David Byrd tells us, Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle premieres this month in theaters and on Netflix. And the script begins with an outtake in 5.
The jungle is changing. Man is taking more of it. And the boy may just be our only hope of survival.
A new telling of the Rudyard Kipling classic The Jungle Book started as director Andy Serkis's vision 5 years ago. The film was initially scheduled for release in 2016, but the date was pushed back so more could be done with its visual effects and to avoid competition with Disney's release of its updated version of The Jungle Book. At the film's London premiere, Serkis, who's best known for his motion capture roles in The Lord of the Rings and the Planet of the Apes films, said the extra time was worth it.
The thing I'm proudest about is that the vision at the beginning of the film is what we've ended up with, and we haven't had to water it down or make it something that it's not, you know, which is great.
In addition to directing the film, Serkis plays the role of Baloo, the bear who befriends Mowgli. The film does not shy away from the darker parts of the story, something that Serkis thinks is important for younger audiences to learn.
I think it's a great bonding family film in that respect, and there's nothing wrong with showing children things that will frighten them and scare them that are real. My problem lies in if kids are playing video games mindlessly and they're hacking and slashing and killing each other, and they're being desensitized. This actually feels the danger in it is really meant, and that I think is the right sort of entertainment.
Indian teenager Rohan Chand plays Mowgli. He says he hopes that the film will help young people to pursue their own life paths and not to give in to peer pressure or to social media shaming.
Mowgli shows them that they don't have to fit in, because he's struggling between these two worlds, and he shows them that they can be true to themselves and they can pick their own unique path, and you don't have to be put into a specific path.
English actors Naomi Harris and Eddie Marson play the wolves who reared Mowgli. Harris says working in motion capture rather than live action was both challenging and rewarding.
It's just a lot more free, you know, because all you do is wear a headpiece which has a camera on it. So no matter what you're doing, it's going to capture every aspect of your performance, both your physicality and all your the minutiae of your facial expressions as well. So it's a wonderfully freeing and imaginative way to work.
Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, also stars Benedict Cumberbatch as the voice of Mowgli's nemesis, Shere Khan the Tiger. Christian Bale provides the voice of Bagheera the Panther, and Cate Blanchett, an Oscar winner in her own right, is the voice of Ka the Python.
I won't fail!
Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, opens in theaters and on Netflix December 7th. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.